The Food Book Fair is a multi-day festival where the nation's best authors, farmers, chefs, artists, publishers, and food enthusiasts gathered in Williamsburg for the second year to celebrate literary food culture. On Saturday, Aaron Fairbanks and Jimmy Carbone of HeritageRadioNetwork.org talked food and conflict. We spoke with writers, scholars, and chefs about the role of food and taste in addressing community and individual conflicts. We caught up with author Joan Nathan, Anna Sophia Pelez, blogger at Hungry Sophia, and Yael Raviv of the Kinetic Art Project, after their panel on food and conflict. We continued the conversation around food as a diplomatic tool within nations, communities, and our own kitchens.
My name is Joan Nathan, and I'm a cookbook author and food writer. I write for the New York Times and Tablet magazine. And I've started my writing career in 1975. And before that, I worked for the mayor of Jerusalem. It was a city of conflict in those days. Jerusalem, the mayor was Teddy Kollek, that most of your listeners probably have never heard of, but they should have. And he was a great mayor and cared about the different people of Jerusalem. So I was his press attaché, and I wasn't a food writer at all, and worked with him. And then all of a sudden, I realized that food was a way to get as an icebreaker for people, and that whenever the mayor went to a community that was hostile to him and he would sit down and eat, they lightened up. And that's really the way I've approached cooking ever since and my food writing.
That's great. Anna?
My name is Anna Sophia Pelaez. I'm a food blogger. My blog is hungrysophia.com, and I'm currently writing my first cookbook, which is going to be published by St. Martin's Press in 2014. I'm working with a photographer, Ellen Silverman, and it's called The Cuban Table, and it's going to be basically looking at Cuban food, where it is now, and also taking a look to see, like, just kind of like what the history of it is, and if we look at it where it is now, it's not in a very good place as far as like what's been lost. So the book is definitely going to try and look to see what can be preserved and what, you know, how it's changed and both the good and the positive. So that's what I'm developing now. So
My name is Yael Raviv, and currently I work with a culinary app developer, Kinetic Art, which produces step-by-step recipe apps for the iPad, but I also have another hat, which is my academic hat, and I teach at NYU's Nutrition and Food Studies Department, courses on food and culture and food and art, and I actually started that whole avenue by writing a dissertation on nationalism and cuisine in Israel. So I've been writing and teaching about food and conflict in the context of Israel for many years, and it's really fun for me to have this conversation with so many people that are engaged with this topic in real life, both writing cookbooks, blogs, feeding people in a variety of contexts. So it was a really, really interesting conversation. There were a lot of really interesting questions that the panel raised, I thought, and my only regret is that it was so short and we couldn't really expand.
What are some of the topics of discussion on the panel today at the Food Book Fair? Joan?
Well, there were two of us really that were talking about the Middle East, or three. And, you know, it's an area of complete conflict. And, you know, how do you use food as a way to convene people? And some felt that it was impossible to do. And others, like me, felt that if you're one-on-one talking to people, you can break a lot of these barriers. But it's difficult. It's very difficult.
I think I was coming at it. It was a very different kind of conflict, because as a Cuban American, it's not so much the difference. It's basically a house divided against itself. So you're living in the United States, which is technically in opposition to the country where your family is from and the culture that you still value and that you still very much feel a part of. So in my view of Cuban food, it's very complicated, because as much as it's a cultural space that I feel like should be apart from politics and from that conflict, it plays into everything that you do. So it's kind of hard to separate yourself completely from the larger conflict without, and essentially sticking your head in the sand or just ignoring some painful questions and some difficult things that come up and that occur. So
I thought that was actually really interesting, because I think a lot of us that write about food in areas of conflict come up against this. You try to create something that sort of goes beyond the conflict or bridges the conflict, but then you realize you can't ignore politics, that food is so interconnected to all these areas of life, mm-hmm. to economics, to politics, to all these things, and you can't really separate it without being mm-hmm. so really artificial, right? And so how do you really write about these things, acknowledging all these issues and all these conflicts and all these complicated questions, but still, you know, mm-hmm. keeping food in the center of what it is you want to talk about? How do you kind of not choose sides but acknowledge the conflict?
And I think that one of the things that came out was that there's one thing about writing about food, and there's another thing about interviewing directly. And if you interview people directly and think about where they're coming from, just in general about life, I think, there's more of a chance of your finding common ground. And then you'll get much better stuff, better recipes, better cultural differences, just like, oh, I was talking to somebody the other day, a Palestinian, about the way that she lets her bread rise. And she said she puts it in the bedroom on top, underneath the covers. And I thought, this is great information. If I didn't interview her, and then I said, what a great idea. Everybody feels good when you're, I don't care who it is or where it is, when you're interested in what they're doing. And we all sit with our, it's ironic that today we sit with these communal tables and we all have our laptops and we're involved in ourselves, but at a communal table. And it's talking directly to people. I totally believe that makes little successes, and little successes make for a better world.
I want to take a step back and talk a little bit about a more kind of personal and maybe intimate conflict or lack thereof. And thinking about conflict within your own homes, one of the things I find so interesting about a lot of the friends in my life is some have really embraced the culinary traditions of their families, and some have actively avoided learning the recipes, the language, understanding that. And there is this idea, I think, that as leaders in the food world, that we maybe have a little bit more control over what happens in our own house. But I know from speaking to a lot of chefs with children who won't eat their food, that's not always necessarily the case, or maybe it shifts over time. And I'm hoping maybe you guys can share some personal stories about your willingness to embrace your mother or your father's interest or disinterest, I guess, in teaching you, or how maybe that's played out in different aspects of your personal kind of home.
Well, I know in my if I had asked my grandparents, how did you learn to cook, they would always say exile. Like, it was always something that they came to later. And my mother, my parents, my father did enjoy cooking, but my mother she just can't. And it's not an interest of hers. But I think seeing my grandparents, we always had that experience where they learned to cook, and they learned to cook later in life. And it was very much part of being with them. And they were discovering Cuban food outside of Cuba, because they had never had that direct contact with it before, until they were in a situation where they needed to, fend for themselves in a way apart from their families, that they had to learn very quickly. So I always very much, associated that with the process. It was always a very personal connection to what you were doing and how you could do it better. So I never, I do have friends, but I have a lot of friends who love Cuban food, but they've never kind of like gone into the kitchen, and they've never taken that kind of agency and like really assumed it for themselves. And I have so many people that tell me like, oh, my mother made this and it was amazing, and why didn't I ask her? And now she's gone. Or there was this one recipe that I didn't get from my aunt, and you kind of rely on these people to kind of always be there and always be making this for you. And it's just, and I think in immigrant communities, you come in and you have your experience in the home, and then as soon as you leave, you have all these other influences. So it's easy to kind of always be looking towards something else and kind of take for granted what you're growing up with. But you have to, if you don't learn that, if you don't kind of like take that, it's going to be lost to you to a certain extent if you don't.
For me, I think it's interesting. In Israel, my dad was the one that cooked, and I think for a long time in Israel, people tried to create this new thing and totally detach themselves, especially people with sort of Eastern European or Central European roots, really wanted to detach themselves from diaspora in any way and create something new and, you know, connected to this new land. So I never learned traditional. Mm-hmm. You know, in my house, we never cooked sort of traditional Jewish recipes from anywhere, really. And when I came to the States, and I have daughters here, and we're not religious, and at some point, you know, when I had kids, I was like, what am I going to teach them about their heritage? You know, we don't really go to synagogue, we don't really do any of the sort of religious things, and food is, you know, ends up being one of those things that you can share with them, and I had to find these recipes that were sort of like, oh, that's what my dad made, and it became sort of this Israeli food that I could teach my kids and I could bring to potlucks. That was a big thing for me. What do you bring to a potluck? That's kind of our food, but, you know, burekas became a big thing, and I have nothing Balkan in my heritage, but it's a very common Israeli food that I learned to make at home, and my dad used to bake for us at home. So we kind of find these interesting connections, kind of sort of making up tradition, if you will, as you go along.
So I'm thinking about, you know, at the White House, when we receive diplomats from different parts of the world, the White House kitchen goes to a great deal of trouble to try to produce foods that will be culturally appropriate and reflective of the cuisine of that guest's region. And I'm wondering if you were to kind of cook a quintessential American meal, how do we even understand that here? I mean, how do we as a culture, because we're such a melting pot, communicate like our what our food is? Is that even possible?
I can just say very briefly that I think one of the sort of quintessential American ways to approach cuisine would be through regions. You know, if you look at southern food or California cuisine, or, I mean, there are these regional foods that are quite defined and unique, and that would be one way of approaching it, but I'm sure there are others.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, but I also think that today, I think multiculturalism is where we are. I mean, the immigration issue is such a big deal because of television, because of the ubiquitousness of chefs everywhere. I think a lot of the regionalism is becoming something of the past, and also the regionalism is all over the country, but I think people are proud of their ethnicity now, and that is a way, maybe combining the two, of a chef coming over. I mean, I as you said that, I thought you were leading someplace else. I immediately thought I would make brisket.
Well, that's your America.
By the way, in Israel, it's interesting, and I think it parallels, right? It's another country that's an amalgamation of immigrants from different places, and I think it took a long time for Israelis to, instead of shunning their roots and trying to forge this new unified community, and the same in the States, right? People tried, work so hard to forge a unified culture and cuisine as a result, but now we don't have to do that as much, right? So there's more room for people kind of looking back, finding their heritage, finding their roots, and expressing their individuality and their unique communities, rather than trying to forge this unified thing that kind of erases difference.
Have you guys seen other examples of like food diplomacy? For example, Sarah Jenkins and the chef went to Cuba. Are there other examples of that going on that you know of? I call it food diplomacy.
Yeah, I think absolutely. Well, I think that there are. I know in October, I'm going with a group of American chefs, 10 chefs, to Israel with Michael Solomonov to go to the place where his brother was killed on the Lebanese border, and they're going to be making a meal there. And they're going to be meeting with Palestinian chefs and Israeli chefs. I think that's diplomacy. And it's something that really started in the 80s when nobody in America had ever heard of Israeli couscous, for example. There was a guy named Michael Ginor, who many of you maybe know. And Michael brought over American chefs. They knew nothing about Israel. And I know Todd English went, Jean-Louis Paladin went, a lot of chefs. and they discovered Israeli couscous, and they loved it because it was a product that worked. You know, it held its shape, mm-hmm. and it didn't get more than al dente. That was one thing, but they also discovered Israeli foie gras. You know, that kind of, and I think that there's all kinds of diplomacy, not just with chefs, people going over and trying different foods. Even Danny Meyer's Shake Shack going to Kuwait and to Qatar, isn't that a form of diplomacy? I don't know.
I mean, I think it's interesting when you brought up Israeli couscous, because I remember the first time that I'd read about it, and I was like just making a recipe, and I was like looking for it. I went to, you know, a neighborhood in Brooklyn that was mostly like Middle Eastern, and I knew what I was looking at, but it was Mediterranean couscous. And even when I tried to ask for the Israeli couscous, they were they didn't want to say it, but it was obvious that's exactly what I was looking for. But they would not, they changed the name.
You know, we're here obviously at the Food Book Fair, and also I think another and powerful tool over history has been books. But is there a special role for cookbooks or in that type of building kind of cross-cultural understanding? Like, what is the role of books, and are you feeling optimistic about the future of the publishing world and books?
Well, I am positive, optimistic about the future for cookbooks, because I have a friend actually where I'm staying who's the leading person in online books, and she says the one thing that is not working online are cookbooks. Mm-hmm. People like to touch them, they like to get them dirty, and you know, that's really something that's important. That said, I mean, you'll have something to say about that too, Yael. But I do think that they're a wonderful document. I feel as if a cookbook is a time and place in history. And if you do a good cookbook that has more than recipes, you're showing the nuances of life. And that's really what we want, you know, in the year. I always think in the year, I don't know, 2020, I want to know if somebody's going to come look at my book and think, oh man, I'm learning something about another place in history. To me, that's the most important thing that I can do, is document what we're doing now.
A way to bring us full circle, solving a lot of problems here
so fun.
In the basement of the White Hotel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
it was really
you.
A pleasure.
Thank you
for having us.
We spoke with author Evelyn Kim and Christoph Hill, owner of Northern Spy Company, about labor injustice in restaurants and the food service industry.
Well, the biggest question, of course, is that there's been a lot of issues in New York and certainly across the United States about whether restaurant workers or people in food services get a fair wage. Do they get a living wage? Do they get benefits? Do they get health care? And as events from the, you know, strikes that have been seen against McDonald's, and certainly the types of strikes or demonstrations that have been against Mario Batali's restaurant at Del Posto, this is a rather hot button issue. And so the topic was, well, is this really a problem, first of all? Second of all, if it is a problem, what can be done to solve it? And third of all, what makes it so complicated? Why is it that restaurants can't or won't pay a living wage and benefits if that, in fact, is the case? So it's not just simply an issue of social justice. It's also an issue of economics. It's also an issue of small business. It's also an issue of race and sexism. So there are a lot of issues that are rather packed into something just as, you know, deceptively simple as food and labor.
Yes, agree with all of that. Evelyn does such a masterful job of summarizing everything. I think so. Where I'm going to weigh in and my point of view on the panel is that, like you, Jimmy, I'm a small business owner in the East Village, which is, as it turns out, not like a gold mine of a lifestyle, but we do it, you know, for the passion and because we like the community in a sense. Like, we like forming communities and we like joining communities. So we're part of a group of people who are, you know, scraping together an existence in East Village. And my interest in this is very much a local one, in the sense of, like, we shop locally, and we also pay bills locally, and we pay employees locally. And this conversation for me was interesting because New York is a very particular labor context. Our restaurants are a very particular labor context. And I'm interested, I'm sort of like you know, if I had my druthers, it would be sort of like this anarchist socialist world, I guess. But, you know, that's not the world. It's not the current world. And if I could make my own rules entirely to how to run my restaurant and not suffer, you know, consumer consequences, I would do that. However, I have to sort of exist with the existing rules. So how can we make those rules better for people? But how can we do so in a way that allows me to continue eking out the small existence that I have?
What, you know, what's really interesting is that, I mean, one of the discussions that came up yesterday was that there's a disparity between what we see locally in New York City and what we're having to see nationwide. And part of the problem is that, you know, I always say this, but in this case, it's very true. Local is as local does. So in terms of trying to get federal legislation for mandating a better wage, so on and so forth, those are not necessarily good or not necessarily equitable across the spectrum for the United States. In the United States, in New York City, frankly, it's a high cost of living. And you also have a diversity of restaurants. It's much different than, you, let's say, Tulsa.
Right.
Or let's say San Francisco. Or even, let's say, or even, let's even break it down further. What you see in Queens is not what you're going to be seeing in Manhattan.
Exactly, right. And I think that where the rubber hits the road on that is, one of the topics that came up yesterday and is sort of near and dear to me is the disparity between what service staff gets paid and our type of restaurants. And by our type of restaurants, I mean a place where, you know, an entree is going to cost like mid-20s and appetizers cost low teens and the average customer spends, you know, $40 for dinner. That's our kind of restaurant. Like beyond those parameters, you know, we're not any more like or dislike any other restaurant. But, you know, it costs, you know, like people spend $40 for dinner. So you know what that means? That means that servers at our place, you know, earn a sort of a gross wage of $40 an hour with tips, and cooks make about $12 an hour. And by New York State law, I am prohibited from taking any of the server tips and distributing them to cooks. That is why people like Batali end up in lawsuits, is that issue. Like, it's the drawing of tips from one pool that you're not allowed to touch and giving it to another pool. More than likely, he was not taking those tips and putting them in his own bank account because he doesn't need that, but he was using them to pay other people in his system who he wanted to compensate more. So we're prohibited from doing that. Most people abide by those rules, most. And by most, even, you know, Sara's figures show like about 87% of people, of employers, don't steal tips. I would like a system that's more equitable across the front and back of the house where that wage is distributed. And then once we have that in effect, then it's much easier to talk about increasing what servers get paid in the whole nation. Because
yeah, I mean, I just want to backtrack a little bit because I think we kind of jumped the gun. I think there needs to be a couple things that need to be broken down first in terms of this discussion. First is the front of the house, back of the house distinction in terms of servers, who are hosts, who are bartenders, who are people who are entitled to tips, and that of the back of the house, who are dishwashers, cooks,
exactly.
so on and so forth. I think in terms of at both ends, there's also, for example, bussers. What is their situation?
I mean, well, bussers in our place make, you know, they do really well too. They do about, because we have such a small staff, our bussers make about $25 an hour. And, you know, that's not like they should make, I'm not saying that to say they should make less. I'm saying that, like, that is a smart gig to have if you're a young guy.
It's because they're getting tipped out.
Because they're two servers, a manager and a busser. So they do really well. Yeah. I would like to have a situation, and you know, all of us, like Jimmy, you know this situation. Everybody is in restaurants and knows this situation. It's like you get this tension between front of the house and back of the house, and the front of the house is, when I say that, I mean mostly the servers, their interests in a way are oddly aligned with my interests in a way that I'm not always comfortable with, because my success is their success. Back of the house, cooks, their interests are not always so aligned with mine, because no matter how busy we are, they make the same wage. What I would actually like is more of a situation where all of them are like a community, and it's like kind of them versus me, and it's them demanding. They're like kids, and I'm like the parent. They're demanding to see better returns from me, and
they
put
the pressure
on me.
They want a better allowance.
Right, they want a better allowance. And like, and then we have like this more of this dynamic where it's like the fact that servers look to me as like being like, no matter what happens, like as long as they're in my good graces, they're happy. I would like them to be more of like, you know, like a camp, and like hold my feet to the fire and say, like, you know, we want all of us to benefit more, not just like the servers to benefit more. Last year, our servers pulled in about $325,000 in tips. Our labor payroll was about $700,000. So it's like you can see that, like, we paid people about $700,000 in checks, and there was an extra pool of $325,000 that went to 11 people. I have 11 service staff on, right? And then the $700,000 went to those 11 plus 15, so 26 people. So it's like it is a lot of money that when customers come into our restaurants, they're dropping an extra. It's like there's a 17% surcharge on their meal by custom. It's not by law, it's by custom. It's like you come in, you spend $20 on the chicken, and you put down an extra $3.50 for your food. And that money should be going to everybody, I feel.
Why have you gotten into these issues?
Because I've always believed, first of all, I do a lot of work with restaurants, and mainly on environmental issues. But the way I see it is that you know, these issues are not just issues of environmental justice. You have to think about all the way down. So it's not just the ground, it's the people who pick your food. It's not the people who cook your food, it's also the people who are going to be serving it as well. It's ultimately issues about justice. You could talk about abstractions, but they ultimately come down to people. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't see much of a distinction between issues of environmental sustainability and that of having sustainable lives in terms of giving servers a living wage or giving tomato workers, you know, a living wage. It's the way I see it, it's all the same issue, because it's in terms of issues about wage and poverty. I mean, this is epiphenomenal. I mean, these issues are certainly epiphenomenal for much larger issues about how do we pay people in the United States? What is it to be a service worker? Why is it that these wages or low-skilled labor, I mean, what kind of power or lack of power do they have? So it's kind of taking a look at the hierarchy of who has power within the system and who doesn't. So this is how I kind of connect the dots.
All right.
And do we have...
Yeah.
And I think this is where we get into, you know, issues of race and ethnicity, yeah, and skin color and all that, because what we're talking about here is a back of the house that's mostly brown,
yeah,
or more. No, well, I'll say, because even in my case, it's not, but more brown often, especially as you get down lower in the ranks. And you have a front of the house that's more white.
Yeah.
Wage equity is very important there, because we're signing a de facto agreement. We're giving a tacit agreement to certain arrangements when we give certain people money and not other people money. So I, as a restaurant owner, you know, the point of the upshot of the conversation yesterday was, I want everybody to make more money. If I had my druthers, they would all get paid like $25 an hour, and I would stay home and I would get, you know, like I would get do other stuff in my life, and I would get like a totally reasonable, not excessive, little check in the mail every once in a while, and I would promote my restaurant and do like lovely things and go grow vegetables and make everybody feel great. But
come
like
to the food book fair.
But it's like that's, you know, but there are numerous obstacles standing in the way of that, you know, and those obstacles are, you know, things like what we talked about, you know, yesterday. We talked about the other NRA, the National Restaurant Association. You know, the idea that the NRA in any way speaks for our type of restaurant is insidious and wrong, and like not like I do not like if they fell off the face of the earth tomorrow, I like would not be upset.
But this is part of the problem with the NRA in general. I mean, when you take a look at the actual restaurant industry as a whole,
yeah,
people like Northern Spy or people, or even let's say 3-star Michelin restaurants, you know, yeah, Mario Batali's place. I mean, they are the 1%.
Yeah, we're like the 0.1%.
Yeah,
we're
the
like
0.1% of exactly. The problem is that one size doesn't fit all. And
right,
you're trying to make legislation at the federal level that is a one size fit all, because federal legislation is a blunt tool.
Well, like, the other half of the sort of the upshot life today is like, if minimum wage was increased across the country, I think that's a fantastic thing, and I think it should, because the people who take the biggest hit from that are large food corporations. It would actually have very little effect on our labor situation, because nobody at our place makes minimum wage. However, the big however on that is like the situation of who gets tips, right? That is like the big issue for restaurants, I feel, in New York of our type, is because if you do that, then there's this other consequence, and that's the consequence that needs to be dealt with, because failing that, like, we're all probably on board. I mean, you know, everybody's like,
like, I don't think anybody should, like, who's working at McDonald's, I think they should all get, you know, $10 an hour minimum, you know, and, like, you know, health benefits, because McDonald's can afford it. Yeah. And other people, however, cannot. So we need to find solutions for things like healthcare, because our restaurant truly cannot afford healthcare at the cost that healthcare is increasing. Our premiums go up 13% a year. Like, what else goes up 13% a year? Does your rent go up 13% a year? Does, you know, I mean, do just my our regular insurance doesn't go up 13%. You know, it's like, that's $10,000 a year, yeah. Extra.
Yeah, but the issue is, and this is what we were discussing yesterday on the panel, is, I mean, this is between a rock and a hard place. At the point of things such, if you were to mandate giving all businesses have to have healthcare, right, which is a very noble idea. I mean, everyone should be, yes, entitled to healthcare.
Right.
But at the same time, if it bankrupts a business, then nobody gets healthcare.
Well, and
so
then,
then it becomes this margins game. Are you able to have enough servers? Because then you start paring down, doing the numbers, right? Yeah. To be able to sustain your restaurant.
What's happened in San Francisco is, because of the healthcare mandate, is prices have gone up probably about 3 or 4% across the board, and everybody's much tighter on other benefits that aren't healthcare benefits. So, you know, vacation pay is like gone, you know.
They have vacation?
They used to in San Francisco. A lot of people had vacation. Yeah. You know, the restaurants I work for used to offer, you know, some vacation pay. That's gone, you know, because now you have sick days and healthcare. Mm-hmm. So other, you know, as you add certain benefits, other benefits get wiped off the board. So what happened is, like, you know, if everybody had to provide healthcare, as we probably someday will as employers, then fine, all prices will go up. But the problem is, it's a really crappy system, because it's lining the pockets of healthcare and industry, who's, you know, if you look at, like, the best performing stocks on the stock market, they're usually healthcare companies nowadays.
Pharma.
Because they're just like, oh, you know what? It's like that thing that you have to do that, like, is mandated by law and that you want to do for ethical reasons. It's going to be 20% more this year. Oh, and next year it's going to be 20% more. Oh, and next, it's like, Jesus, where does it stop? You know, where does it stop? Like, you don't have a choice.
But this is the reason why this issue about food and labor is not simply a cut and dried issue of, is this right or is this wrong? In terms of, once again, you know, we were talking about this in panel yesterday. No one wants people living in poverty. No one wants people living on being exposed to the racism, everything that's associated with issues about food and labor. But at the same time, the reality, it's much, much harder to solve than simply just saying, well, just give them more money. Or say, let's just give them healthcare. It involves a set of economic realities that I think a lot of people in food justice, and I'm probably going to get shot for saying this, are often blind to.
The big point being is that, like, we need to restart a conversation about how, you know, how money is received, like what we're actually paying for stuff. You're saying the externalities, like if you're tipping on food, that's the true cost of the food. The chicken isn't $20, it's $20 plus the tip and the tax, right? Which is about 25% surcharge. So we need to address, like, as a nation, like, why are we tipping people? Why don't if we just wipe away tips, like, then we can actually then we have to pay people real wages. Like, because the National Restaurant Association uses the existence of tips is a rationale to keep this $2.13 thing. That's why they're allowed to do it, is because, oh, but they got more money coming in because of the tips. Just wipe the damn tips away, and then nobody's going to work for $2.13. Nobody would, right? And they'd be like, screw this. I'm going to, like, I can, you know, go pluck chickens for, like, $5 at least. You know, that's a better job. So, you know, I mean, there's plenty of crappy jobs.
There's plenty of crappy
jobs out there in the world that are better than that. So then it's like, okay, then we have to, then we readjust everything. They're like, oh, crap, you know, we can't, that's no longer an argument. So it's like, if you make these systemic changes, then, like, the conversation changes, right? You have to. And that's the same thing with labor costs. I mean, with healthcare costs. It's like, you know, like, there's, like, if we could get past, like, the sort of, like, the red state, blue state divide of, like, you know, who's for and against, it's like you have to realize that, like, the connection of healthcare to your employer is, like, a really screwed up anachronism of this country. And it's like, it hurts employers, it hurts the employees. Like, you have to wait 90 days, you know, before you're on new healthcare. Like,
well, it's not even that.
Like, and cooks change jobs every year. You know, yeah. It's like they come in for a year, then they're gone.
But it's also part of a larger system of the asking the employer to be in loco parentis is a ridiculous idea.
What does that mean? Is that Greek?
In loco parentis means, you know, in
loco parent.
Yeah, in lieu of parents.
The, oh, okay. Yeah, you know, I'm a terrible parent.
Yeah, I was about to say I'm not telling your kid that or your wife. But in terms of asking them to take that responsibility, frankly, it's a misplaced responsibility.
Yeah, exactly.
That's government's responsibility. Exactly. It's not
or like
employers.
A state. You know, like I mean, so this stuff, it's like, you know.
Yeah, but once again, this it just goes to show what the reason why this conversation got so heated is that the answers aren't so simple.
Right.
The question isn't so simple.
After the panel on modern farming, we caught up with the panelists to talk about the media's role and responsibility in reporting food issues. We spoke with Anne-Marie Gardner, the editor-in-chief at Modern Farmer, Keith Stewart, author of Guide to Growing Organic Vegetables and Herbs for Market, Maria Rodell, the CEO of Rodell Inc., and Corby Coomer, writer of The Atlantic.
Well, I mean, the issues seem to be kind of sometimes the same everywhere, which is, you know, what's the difference between local and organic and, you know, non-organic, and how can people trust what they eat and what they buy, and also how can young farmers get involved in farming organically, and just how does it all work together, this whole local and organic food movement.
So were you able to come up with an answer? Because I'm dying to know.
Oh, you weren't at the panel?
I wasn't at the panel.
Well, I will tell you my answer, which is one of the reasons I wrote Organic Manifesto, was to get to the answer myself. And that is local food is important, but if it's not organic, you're poisoning your own local community. And ultimately, everything is local to somebody. So, you know, the best decision you can make for your own health and the planet's health and every community's health is to buy organic food. But the gold standard is local organic, except when it comes to coffee, which has yet to be grown in Brooklyn. I don't know, is anybody growing coffee in Brooklyn?
Not commercially. They're certainly roasting it right down the street. Yeah. And they're selling a very beautiful and expensive hand-drawn map of coffee in Brooklyn for where to buy and drink it. In fact, I just bought it.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yes.
So that's made in Brooklyn, then?
Yeah, it's very, it's wood blocked or linoleum blocked.
You know, gorgeous.
For $5. Yes, it's gorgeous. I hope somebody makes a lot of money off it.
Keith, you have a great story. I mean, I've seen you in Union Square for, I don't know, 15 years or more, and you're from New Zealand. How did you become a farmer?
How did I become a farmer? Well, I was living and working in New York City. 17 years I lived here, actually. In the last several years in the corporate world, and it just didn't really suit me that well. I was not a happy camper in there, and kept wanting to get outside, do more physical work, get involved with nature. So I got this notion of buying some land. Back in those days, land wasn't so expensive. We bought a whole dairy farm for $215,000, mm-hmm. which seemed like a lot then, mm-hmm. but... And, you know, bought the land and basically set out to try my hand at farming. And I loved it. It was the best move I ever made.
And you decided from the beginning to pursue organic production?
Well, in the second year, I got certified organic. In those days, it was a lot easier. Very quickly, I didn't start out with any really preconceived notions about organic versus not conventional. It was just... I wanted to work on the land, but it didn't take long before I realized that I didn't want to use chemicals, and so organic certification was a natural path to take.
And can you maybe talk a little bit about the infrastructure necessary to, you know, around organic farming? It's not as though you start your farm and you're like, hey, I'm organic, and everybody accepts and understands that there's a multitude of, you know, regulations and certifications. And I think as consumers, it becomes a little bit challenging, especially with the media putting out so much information, like organic is, you know, not as strong of a certification as it used to be, or it means this or doesn't mean that, or you come to a farmer's market and farmers will put up signs that will say organic but not certified. You know, are there kind of tools more broadly that we should be putting in place to ensure that, you know, organic, you know, means what we think it means, or do we have even understand that? Like, what are the kind of pieces around, you know, outside of the actual farmer that are useful to protecting that designation?
Well, you're not supposed to say you're organic unless you are certified organic. I mean, you're certainly not supposed to put up a sign, right?
Right.
So that's, you've got to understand that. I think, you know, organic is meaningful. It's a third-party sort of inspection, third-party involvement in the process to sort of keep you honest. But there's lots could be said. I mean, you've got local organic, which is what I'm a fan of, and you've also got more industrial organic, which is another story altogether. It probably means a lot less chemicals are being used somewhere. It could be in China, it could be in Mexico, it could be in Ecuador. It's tougher to know your grower, virtually impossible. So there's a lot of issues around organic. The key thing is sustainable. Are we farming in a way that we can keep doing it 100, 1,000 years from now?
Something that you said and that I thought was a very provocative point was somebody at the back of the audience asked, what about all the farmers who say that they're very low spray or they're no spray and that it really is as good as organic, just as you're saying these signs? And what both Maria and Keith said was, without one standard, you don't really know that it's organic. And it's so ironic that we in the media who are always saying, know your farmer, meet your farmer, talk to them about how they're raising their food, it comes down to, well, you know, how trustworthy is what they're saying? Are they saying one thing that means their understanding of what being organic is, but it's not really what the standards mm-hmm. say? And when Maria said that her local supermarket in Pennsylvania has recently tripled the amount of space it devotes to organic, it's a powerful argument for one set of standards mm-hmm. that will increase the amount of acreage under organic farming.
Sure. And as, I mean, kind of sitting in this room, we have representatives from several media organizations. And, mm-hmm. and I'm curious, you know, as the world of media seems to be changing in the way that people are getting information, much more in the moment, you know, mm-hmm. you have these social media tools like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, the potential for things to and information to move very quickly, wrong information, right information. I mean, how do we, as a movement, do you think, capture some of the opportunities that provides and maybe protect ourselves against some of the misinformation? I mean, we're going up against these corporate models, so how do we, from a grassroots level or something else, kind of come together to take advantage of some of the opportunities that are offered by that shift in how information travels?
You know, we have to put out more and better good information, because it's more and more of a danger when I think of what most websites do in terms of sponsored content, which is putting up articles that look like they're written by the media outlet you think you're reading. It is getting harder and harder to sift out these pieces of information. So we at the Atlantic try to put out really good sustainability and health reports, especially health. And I would say that Rodel Press is the leader of this in putting out lots of good information and just lots of it. So I think you have to combat it with as much as you can. We've just been joined by Anne Marie Gardner, who's mm-hmm. trying to work on this very problem herself by putting out more good information.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm late. Yeah, we're reporting 5 original stories a day, too.
And so where, I mean, as an organization, where are the inputs for that information coming from? I mean, how are you deciding or designating, like, who's the expert or, who, you know, who's the person to kind of follow and vetting that content?
Well, because we're mostly generalist journalists, I think we like to follow the lead of the Atlantic, you know, so we cover everything. We've been looking at your website going, if we could only have it be like this. But no, seriously, because they're credible journalists, so they go and look objectively at all the sides of the story, and that's how we approach it. We don't, I mean, obviously we get a sense of what people are interested in by some of the comments and the questions, and by going to events like this, you hear what people ask. But, you know, I think we have a global network, so we're trying to find answers in different countries and come back and bring it together and make a report.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that for my own media organization, that just what you choose to cover is inherently a political decision on, mm-hmm. on some level. And so we're really working hard to figure out how do we better make those decisions. I'd be curious how your organizations kind of deal with that.
I mean, I think the biggest challenge is, you know, it's like there's good news and bad news. I mean, the good news about social media is that, you know, people can share a lot of information really quickly. There's a very high or low advertising tolerance. People don't really want to see advertisements in there. But, you know, and you can sign a petition and feel like you did something. You know, the bad news is people in Washington aren't reading those petitions. You know, they're not listening to those petitions. Without advertising money, people aren't paying for content. So, you know, like, it's hard for all of us in this industry to make a living anymore, which means we're not able to, you know, spend as much time and resources doing really in-depth, you know, quality journalism. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. And I think, you know, people have to realize that, you know, free content, you know, only can, you know, take this world so far. I mean, at some point people are going to have to start, you know, paying if they want really high value, just paying for high value food, mm-hmm. paying for high value content.
I can say something that people can do, since I didn't mention it in the beginning, and that is read my books. I've written a book, and I write a column for a magazine, a food magazine in the Hudson Valley called The Valley Table. But a lot of my articles are about issues around food and sustainability and how the public should choose. I've also written a book called It's a Long Road to a Tomato, which it is a long road to, mm-hmm. and recently a book called Story's Guide to Growing Organic Vegetables and Herbs for Market, mm-hmm. which just tells it all. So there you go. Self-promotion.
Awesome.
Well, that makes
you
sense.
Told me to do it in the
I did. I told him, because the more information you can rely on and learn from, the better. And I don't think that bad books come out as much as misguided kind of the new health nostrum and the new wonder diet plans. But I think that most food books and most books about the food system are worth reading in one way or another. There isn't the same filtering out sponsored content problem with actual books mm-hmm. that there is with magazines.
Just like you want to know your source of your food. I mean, a lot of the headlines that you'll see, like, on TV news or, you know, newspapers or even, you know, Huffington Post. I mean, if you look behind and say, okay, who did the research that says, you know, GMO corn is good for you? Well, it's, you know, sponsored by the American Corn Association, which is funded by, you know, Monsanto. So, you know, it's you know, you have to kind of unravel the trail of both your food and your news.
You know, how do I kind of like step back and talk to one person that I know and love about this issue in a way that is compelling and not, you know, like he's not feeling attacked? And I don't know if you guys have had similar experiences and found language that works, but I do think one of the weaknesses is that we often end up talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And I'm always looking for like ways to...
Maria has a very good point about generational change and probably another good point she's about to make.
Well, I mean, I think it's it comes down to love. And, I mean, I have this friend on Facebook who I went to high school with who's like, I mean, he's a gun-toting, you know, against everything that I stand for. But, like, we stay in the conversation because, you know, and actually organic and is the one thing we agree on. In fact, I was thinking that would be a great, you know, ad campaign, you know, me versus him with his guns and his, you know, his religion. Like, we can, you know, we can agree on organic, but you really have to like believe that if we love each other enough and we don't get escalate into anger and war, you know, that ultimately we all want the same thing. You know, we all want our children to be healthy. We want, you know, the world to continue. But it takes a lot of patience, and it's hard.
I think if I studied public health, and I got a master's degree in behavioral science, and I was interested in how to change behavior through mass media. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I've sort of come full circle from that. But I did start writing about health, and I think that the food system can be changed in a similar way, maybe as we started to affect smoking, mm-hmm. right? So it was a government level, but it was also a perception, because suddenly it became not cool to smoke. And I can't believe that happened in my lifetime, because the cigarette advertisers had done such a brilliant job mm-hmm. making it cool. Mm-hmm. But it's not cool to smoke anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, if someone smokes, it's very like, ooh, you smoke. Mm-hmm. And so that took a long time, and I think that was a combination of government and marketing. And I think that we can do the same with the food system, mm-hmm. and buying organic now is becoming cool, and it's mm-hmm. becoming the right thing to do, right. and people want to associate themselves with that. It's like recycling. Mm-hmm. You know, how many people that don't recycle get like, you don't throw away your plastics? Like, it's becoming like that, and I think, mm-hmm. you know, it's going to become more of that, and I think that's going to help,
yeah.
you know, move the masses.
Yeah. And I mean, my grandfather started Organic Gardening magazine in 1942, and I mean, then it was like totally crazy, you know, and outlandish, and right. you know, he wouldn't take cigarette advertising even then, and it was like a radical move. And you know, it's when you just look at like where we are now, it's like, oh, you know, we have so much farther to go. But if you look at like where we've come from, it's actually pretty amazing. And you yeah. know, so I'm very hopeful. But you know, the reality is too, there's a whole new generation of conventional chemical farmers as well. So because those chemical companies are funding most of the agricultural universities mm-hmm. in the United States. So it's not going to go away just with one generation. It'll evolve, but it's still a lot of people out there who are you know, younger our yeah. age.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot of work to do mm-hmm. and a lot, maybe more books and articles and to write and thinking to do. I just want to thank you guys for taking some time out to talk more after you've already shared so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this special program. Visit our website to hear our 30-plus weekly podcasts and learn about membership programs. HRN is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.